You're listening to Human Rights Talks, organized by the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies.
Welcome back to the series of discussions on international security, hosted by MIGS on X Spaces. This third episode focuses on China's transnational repression, including its impact on politicians and activists abroad, Beijing's extradition and censorship efforts, as well as the challenge to tackle this threat at the legislative level. The experts featured in this discussion are Laura Harth, campaign director at Safeguard Defenders, and Luke DePulford, co-founder of the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. This panel is moderated by Kyle Matthews, the executive director of MIGS.
We're very pleased today to have an X Space Live discussion on transnational repression, the long arm of authoritarianism. And we're organizing this with the support of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung in Canada. They're a key partner to have serious discussions about human rights, security issues related to China, as a lead up to the upcoming Montreal International Security Summit that will be held in Canada in October of this year. Just to put this into perspective, we're in Canada. The issue of transnational repression has been growing as a both a domestic and a foreign policy issue. We've had different diaspora groups in Canada who are being targeted by authoritarian governments, both online and offline. And most of the focus has been on China. China seems to be the one country that has the ability, the willingness, and the tools to take this to a level that doesn't compare to other countries. But I would maybe like just to start off, starting with Luke and then with Laura, but I'd like you to start off and tell us about, can you describe your organization's efforts and activities aimed at confronting transnational repression? Luke, can you tell us about your work on this?
Yes, of course. So for those who don't know, the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, or IPAC, is a group of cross-party legislators now represented in 35 countries and growing on every continent. And yeah, it's just a group of MPs representing extraordinarily broad ideologies and geographies who are all united in concern around some of the issues associated with the rise of the People's Republic of China, and particularly its increasing assertiveness abroad, as well as its clamping down on rights at home. And I guess transnational repression is something that we'd fit into the assertiveness abroad category for sure. And I guess that there are two main buckets of activity as far as IPAC legislators are concerned. The first is that IPAC has on occasion taken up cases of transnational repression in order to try to lend the weight of the voices of parliamentarians to their cases. So, you know, for example, there was a potential extradition case. As we know, the People's Republic of China has been known to abuse Interpol red notices and to pursue people, particularly in countries that are especially exposed to China economically, in order to persecute them, I suppose, politically, and in some cases to try to take political distance and get them to go back home. In a couple of cases, IPAC has lent its weight to those cases in the hope that by appealing to authorities like Interpol or the local police authorities, they might be able to stall their extradition and raise their cases. So that's one bucket of activity. Another would be just around the policy responses. Now, Laura's much more qualified to talk on this than me, but all I would say is that last year in Prague, when IPAC had its annual summit, one of the six areas of China policy that all these MPs wanted to focus on was transnational repression, and they agreed something of a blueprint for international political activity on transnational repression, particularly parliamentary activity. And there was a kind of shopping list of things that they want to achieve. Chief among those is really raising awareness among police authorities around it, who are not well coordinated, not well briefed, and often don't know what to do when cases of transnational repression present themselves. So those are the two main buckets of activity, taking up cases and then pushing for coordinated policy reform in the different countries represented by IPAC politicians. I think Laura's can probably fill in some of the policy detail here.
Thanks, thanks, Luke. Laura, I'd love to hear. I know you were in the Canadian media just yesterday talking about some of these issues, but tell us about some of the wider work of your organization and your efforts to counter transnational repression.
Yes, thank you, Kyle, and thank you for hosting this space. So Safeguard Defenders traditionally is an organization focused on human rights inside China. As the name says, it tries to work with human rights defenders inside China, support their work, and defend them, obviously, in a way, from the authoritarianism that they face and the difficulties that come with that. Now, what we've seen over the course of the past years is that, unfortunately, that kind of authoritarian persecution is no longer limited to inside China, but increasingly presents itself abroad as well. And I'm happy that before you mentioned in your introduction how prolific the People's Republic of China is in those transnational repression efforts compared to other authoritarian actors, right? And they are indeed the state actor that is the most engaged or on the largest scale engaged in these kind of efforts, be it online or offline, be it by putting pressure on families back in China or holding family members back in China hostage, to, you know, outright kidnapping attempts on foreign soil. So they are really the prime, I would say, actor in this space. So as we were seeing that Safeguard Defenders first started to kind of employ the knowledge it has and the reporting it has on the human rights situation inside China, particularly what the state of the judicial system is, what the state of the penitentiary system is, and how all that is, you know, would put a democratic country or any country really would make it violate international law if it were to return people to China forcefully. So we started out by direct actions, assisting people and assisting defense attorneys in extradition proceedings to stop that from happening, as it would violate international law. But as we were going through those cases, increasingly we started seeing also the alternative means, right, in which the People's Republic of China tries to forcefully return people to China to obviously prosecute them there and further harm, violate their human rights. So from that very much, if you will, on the ground experience of working with victims of this type of transnational repression, we started to do extensive research, which led first to a long report on the state of extraditions to China and the way to combat it. Then it led to a report called Involuntary Returns, which really documented for the first time all the ways in which the People's Republic of China goes after people abroad to force them to return to China, which is only one of the means of transnational repression, obviously, but maybe the worst one in the case of China. And that, you know, following those threads, if you will, once you start looking into an issue, we obviously came across this issue of so-called overseas police service stations or liaison stations that had been set up by some local public security authorities in China in coordination and cooperation with United Front organizations in many countries around the world. Now, it was not only the police, public security authorities in China engaging in these kind of operations. We've seen courts do it. We've seen procuratorates do it. We see consulates and embassies do it. So we're kind of mapping those networks engaged in, you know, some of the most extreme instances of transnational repression. So yeah, as by way of introduction, I'll stop there.
Thanks, Laura. And thanks to the work of Safeguard Defenders, we've uncovered, or Canadians have become known, that there are these police stations in Canada, of which there are two in Montreal, the city that we're reaching you from today. So this is it's not an abstract issue; it's a serious issue, and there are things that we need to do to counter it. So I'd like to ask Luke next, and then followed by Laura. I'm wondering what is the impact of transnational repression on individuals and diaspora communities? Luke, you work very closely with parliamentarians. We just found out there are a bunch of parliamentarians across the world, there are members of your network that were hacked, their emails were targeted. And we also know that there are a lot of other diaspora groups, like the Uyghur diaspora, the pro-democracy activists, the Hong Kong activists, the Tibetans. I'm wondering, Luke, could you tell us, based on your work, like, what are you seeing? What's the impact of this on individuals?
This is a huge question. I'm grateful for it. Thanks, Carl. I mean, there are a few things about it. Let's stick with the politics, first of all. If we can call cyber espionage or interference activities transnational oppression, and I think we can, then it influences and impacts the way that politicians go about their business, as it's intended to. And in some cases, it can really impact their jobs. So let's think for a second about Kenny Chu, a Canadian case. As you know, he's a former Conservative MP. And when his opposition to the national security law in Hong Kong became known, there was a very, very heavy lobbying effort against his candidacy for re-election in your recent election in Canada. And we know what happened with Kenny. He lost his seat. Now, we're not able to say that that was directly attributable to the organizing of the Chinese diaspora communities within his constituency. But we do know that there was a swing away from him that didn't seem to correspond with the swing in the rest of the country. So there are some very interesting things to be looked into there. And I know that the reports on interference, the inquiry on interference, which is currently ongoing in Canada, I hope will have something to say about Kenny's case, because that's a really serious example of transnational repression there. And the idea is to try to silence dissent. It's to try to inculcate self-censorship among these politicians. And we see it all over the world. There's another case with IPAC after the Washington, D.C. communique, our summit there a couple of years ago, was agreed. There are a couple of signatories from a country I won't name who were called in by the Chinese ambassador who complained that their signatures were on that document. Now, credit to those politicians, they wouldn't remove their signatures, but we haven't heard much from them since. Now, this could well be an example of self-censorship resulting from transnational repression, this kind of extraterritorial bullying that the PRC does so effectively, could well be seeing that in action. Now, with regard to these recent cyber attacks, I don't know if the listeners on this call or listeners to the podcast will know, but we found out recently that in 2021, there was an attack by a Ministry of State Security-sponsored hacking unit called APT-31 on the whole of the IPAC network, with very few exceptions. And the attempt there was to try to garner enough information from this global group of politicians to then mount more serious escalating cyber attacks on them so that they could try to gain access to their emails and, you know, eventually totally hack them. I would say that in countries where, I guess, members of parliament know that by standing up to the PRC, they're taking a certain amount of risk and they're exposing themselves, they're unlikely to be dissuaded by this kind of activity. But let's consider countries where perhaps that's not the case, Belt and Road countries, where, for example, some of the governing parties really don't want to hear dissent around the behaviour of the PRC from their members of parliament. If those people start thinking, if I join this IPAC group and I start talking about the challenges associated with China, then people are going to start trying to hack me. It may well put them off wanting to do it at all. So we're not just seeing personal intimidation here. We're actually seeing the subversion of parliamentary debate in places where people who otherwise would have spoken up feel that speaking up entails risks that they don't want to take. So that's a bit of a whistle-stop tour there, Carl. Over to you.
Thanks, Luke. No, I think your point of it's what this means for democracy and our ability to have discussions and our lawmakers are able to come forward with policies. It's very serious, unlike anything we've seen in recent times. Laura, could you maybe just talk about, what is the impact on diaspora communities? You work closely with human rights groups, those advocating for change.
This space was downloaded via spacesdown.com. Visit to download your spaces today.
What are you seeing?
I think a lot of it looks like what Luke actually described, except it's happening on a more profound level, I would say. So obviously, as Luke said, what the PRC ultimately aims at is to kind of control the narrative that is being, set abroad about the CCP. It wants it to align as much as possible with its interests, with its goals, be those domestic or internationally. And to that end, it wants to, silence dissent, it wants to silence critics, and it wants to divide critics, right, so that they can't organize or they don't feel it's safe to organize. So all the tactics we see, most of them are really geared towards that objective, right? How do we actually control overseas diasporas so that they don't feel safe to speak up, so that they may not feel it's safe to talk to their neighbors or to other members of the community about what they're really thinking. And so definitely they don't speak publicly about what they think about the CCP in case that's a negative. Now, what it does is, and obviously most of the time, the stories that we kind of see coming out are those of high-profile dissidents who often go through very extreme experiences of transnational repression, mainly where their parents are being targeted or being held hostage. And obviously the cost that imposes on people is very heavy. But what it also does is these examples of high-profile activists actually create a very profound climate of fear inside the entire communities, right? Where the entire community is kind of put on notice, like, you could be next. You want to be careful because this might happen to you as well. And so they go into that mode of self-censorship, if you will, where they will even, where they choose simply not to speak up or not to say what they think because the cost might be too heavy. They're thinking about their family members back in China. Maybe they're thinking about their kids wherever they're living. You know, they just don't want to deal with that kind of harassment. And so in that sense, it does mimic a lot what Luke described, what MPs or other people might be going through as well. There's one last thing I'd like to highlight in that is, you know, with that climate of fear also comes this climate of divisiveness. So people are very distrustful to one another in communities because you never know who might be, you know, potentially a spy, who might be talking back to the authorities, who might have been pressured themselves, right? Because their parents have been taken hostage. So they're kind of being coerced to report back to Beijing. So there's that distrust. And with all that also comes a deep sense of paranoia where, you know, everything obviously starts to look suspicious. And that doesn't mean that there's always something happening, but people become so scared that everything just, yeah, becomes suspicious, might be seen as a sign off. And again, this is, I think, a state of mind that the CCP wants to induce in people. This is not like a corollary. This is exactly the objective. Like, it wants people to think that it can get to them, that it can watch them, that it can hear what they're saying, that it can read their emails, read their texts, so that people, again, start self-censoring. And so that's really kind of how it comes full circle.
Thanks, Laura. You know, we're joining you today. We're on the sidelines of a major conference put on by McGill University and the Wilson Center here in Montreal today on Canada, the U.S., and the ascendancy of China. And we've been talking about tech, disinformation, foreign influence, and transnational repression. And I'm wondering if based, and maybe start with Luke and then moving back to you, Laura, I'm wondering if you could give us an idea in which countries, regions is China's transnational repression most prevalent, and what factors contribute to this? Is it economic dependency? Is it military aid, diplomatic pressure? Is this happening everywhere, or is it concentrated in certain parts of the world?
Well, I think it depends what kind of transnational repression you're talking about, because I think it does manifest in different ways in different places. So, you know, Turkey would be a place where there's a heck of a lot of transnational repression, and it can be much more explicit in those places. You'd normally expect, let's say, Five Eyes countries who've taken a slightly more hawkish stance when it comes to their foreign policy towards China to be a bit more resistant to transnational repression. But only a couple of days ago, after the visit of Xi Jinping to France, there is an allegation that there was an attempted abduction from the streets of Paris of a Uyghur in a normal Parisian apartment block. So, you know, it can be extremely severe, and I think it's all over. Now, Laura's done much more mapping around this kind of thing than me. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a diversity. If you look at places in Central Asia, it's been extraordinarily bad. Like in Tajikistan, there have been forced repatriations again of Uyghur and Kazakh minorities who are in Tajikistan. Extremely serious, and the kind of thing you wouldn't normally see elsewhere. But then you're dealing with you're monitoring intimidation, cyber espionage of diaspora and other communities in more Western-based countries that are a bit more farther afield. So I think there's a huge variation in the way that this broad kind of umbrella term transnational repression plays out, and I think it manifests differently in different countries. And the severity of the expression, I think, probably does correlate a little bit to the closeness of those leaderships or the exposure of those countries to China economically. Over to you, Laura, as somebody who's done much more mapping around transnational repression than me.
Thanks, Luke. I'm going to agree with you in part and disagree in another part. You are right. This is happening everywhere. And it does take on slightly different forms, but I wouldn't say that the different format is because the PRC is employing different, you know, forms of transnational repression depending on what place it is acting in, but it depends on the level of cooperation or, let's say, silent complicity that host governments are willing to give, right? So the PRC's playbook is pretty, like, it kind of, we can see the same things happening all over the world. But the main difference is, you know, today's Canadian government might not agree to have someone extradited to China or might try and stop an illegal coercive operation to return someone to China against their will, whereas, you know, the police in the Solomon Islands might be very willing to have the Chinese police just come in, get this person, and bring them back. But so the objective in the end is the same, and the kind of methodology is also the same. It just varies a little bit depending on the cooperation of the authorities. I don't think there's one place in the world where it's not happening. The final objective of the CCP, again, is establishing control. It wants to control the narrative. It wants to control its diaspora. It wants to control the way foreign democracies or governments talk about China, talk to China, talk with China. So that kind of remains the same, and the playbook remains the same. There's maybe one thing that I'd highlight that hasn't had a lot of attention. I think over the past years, obviously, several governments have started paying attention to this issue, including the US, Canada, the UK, some European governments as well. And what I think it does, it creates kind of the idea that, you know, things are getting worse, right? Because in all the places where governments start paying attention, suddenly we start seeing all these stories popping up, much more than, you know, we saw before in the public sphere. And that might create the idea that things are worse in those countries, that there's a bigger emphasis of the PRC on those countries. I would say that's not necessarily true. I think it's a good thing. It's a painful exercise, but talking about these things publicly means shedding a light on them. So we're going to hear more things. I am more concerned with countries where we're not seeing those stories pop up, because when you talk to diaspora communities there, the situation is not better than, you know, in UK, in the US, or in Canada. It's often worse. But they don't feel there's a safe space to even start raising the issue. So I think that's where still a lot of work needs to be done, and being very conscious of the fact that this is literally happening, as the CCP says it, as, you know, the PRC authorities tell it, in every single country around the world.
Thanks, Laura, and for you know, reminding us that as democracies aren't doing the best job in protecting citizens from this, there are diaspora groups in other parts of the world that don't have civil society or media or even political opposition that can stand up for them. So I think that's a key point. You know, I'm going to ask one last question, and I think this is, you know, it's what approach should democratic governments take to better protect their citizens from Beijing's intimidation campaigns? What are a couple things that are not being done that should be done? Laura, you said that this is, we're seeing governments are saying this is a bigger problem. They're admitting to it. They're being more transparent. What are some things that should be done? Every country is different. Different parliaments are different all over the world. But maybe, Luke, starting with you, what are some of the things that you think can be done to better protect citizens from this?
Well, I think the key thing is getting to grips with what foreign interference is. You know, most countries really aren't over that and don't have legislation to deal with that. You know, we're still in this massive firefight to try to get governments around the world to face up to the huge threat that the activity of the United Front Work Department poses to their countries. And for the most part, in many countries, they're still reluctant to do that. You'll find that throughout intelligence and security communities around the world, there is, I think, a broad and shared understanding of the depth and severity of the problem around the United Front Work Department. But that isn't the case throughout governments, and you often find that governments are, in fact, resistant to doing stuff. Let me just take the UK as an example. Even though we had a parliamentary committee report, our most senior parliamentary committee report last year on China, this was the Intelligence and Security Committee report, say that the United Front Work Department had penetrated every area of the UK economy, and this is the principal node for transnational repression in the UK. Even though we had that, we're still having a debate over whether or not China should be included in the enhanced tier of this thing called the Foreign Influence Registration Scheme, which is a new piece of legislation for us, which is supposed to categorize countries into those we trust and those we don't. We're still having a debate about that, even though our intelligence and security services are saying, this United Front thing is a real problem. We need to face up to it. Now, if that's the UK, and, I think Laura can come in on this as well. If that's the UK, then we're going to see that pattern play out across the rest of the world. I mean, I think Canada has been fairly forward-leaning when it's come to at least trying to deal with United Front activity. But that's not the case over the rest of the world. So we've got a big block around that. I'd want to identify that as one of the key things that we have to deal with. We need legislation in democratic countries to address and to criminalize aspects of foreign interference, particularly when it comes to this kind of extraterritorial repressive activity that we can see playing out all over the world with China. So that's one really key thing. And I think the other thing is that unless our police authorities have got some understanding of what this thing is, in addition to having the legislation to deal with it, then they're not going to be able to deal with it. Now, we've got people I can even see on this call who I think have experienced themselves transnational repression in various countries. And I know, and Laura knows from speaking to them, that when they go to police authorities and talk about it, the police authorities very often just shrug. They haven't got any idea what to do. And very often, even if they want to do something about it, they lack the legislation to either issue any kind of arrest warrant or let alone charges and try to secure a prosecution. There's just no legislative framework for it. So those are two things that I'd want to point out. I guess the final thing from my own personal experience, like in a weird way, doing this kind of work on China also exposes you to a different form of transnational repression. Because I, along with loads of other people, have been named in national security law cases in Hong Kong, I was warned by our Foreign Office of a risk of extradition to China or Hong Kong from anywhere that had an extradition agreement with those places. I was expecting, when this news was conveyed to me, that there would be some sympathy and some support. So I asked them, okay, so what do I do then when I travel to countries that have these extradition agreements? And the response was, you travel at your own risk. And I was like, oh, thanks very much, Foreign Office. That's really helpful. So there's an unwillingness, I think, even to provide minimal support to victims of transnational repression in many countries. So listing those three things, I really think we need legislation to deal with interference together with understanding of the United Front. I think we need better police training and understanding. And I also think that we need willingness to support and political will. I'm not sure that we have any of those things at the moment.
Thanks. Laura, I'd like to have your final thoughts on what should be done either in countries or globally.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. I have to be honest, listening to Luke, who, by the way, summarized perfectly, I think, what are the first kind of steps we need to take. So I'm not going to repeat those. But I just want to conclude, listening to that, you don't know whether to laugh or to cry, right? Because obviously the situation is quite dire. People are going through this every single day, which is obviously sad and something all of us want to do something about. But then, as Luke said, you get into these quite, I would say, almost comical situations, right? Where the authorities that should be protecting you, that should be all about defending democracy, defending the rights of the people living on their territories and so on, kind of, shrug and really want to look away because they do not want to deal with this. And so I think, everything starts with the willingness to recognize this issue, address this issue and grow awareness of this issue. And I think if we have those three We can work out, you know, the legislative kinks that we need. We can work out the training that law enforcement needs. We can work out the kind of understanding that the judiciary needs. There's a lot that needs to be done, but if we don't have that willingness to recognize and address the issue, we're not going to go anywhere.
I couldn't agree more with what you said, Laura. I think particularly speaking to diaspora groups here in Canada, they say the same thing when they reach out to police authorities, just a lack of interest or a shrugging of the shoulders. There's nothing we can do. For those of you who are on this call, I please ask you, follow Luke, give him a follow on Twitter or X. Same thing with Laura. They're two of the most important voices that are working on this issue. Please follow them. I know I do, and I learn something from them every day. Part of this is to educate our policymakers and others. And Luke and Laura, I just want to really thank you on behalf of our colleagues at the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Race Studies. Thank you for joining us today.